21 seconds. Chick, chick, chick. Hi, and welcome to Music Weekly. I'm Paul McInnes. And on this week's retrofitted Thunderbird of a show, sparks will fly as we talk Art and Ingmar Bergman with the synth pioneers. Sparks. New feature alert. Alexis Petridis will join us to pick over the bones of Julian Casablancas in our inaugural album club. We'll have the best of you. But first, let's all take a deep breath and relax. That was Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Relax, their song about the benefits of a glass of Chardonnay and a foot spa. It's 25 years since Frankie Goes to Hollywood ruled the world. A collection of fierce pop hits, savvy marketing and in-your-face sexuality, Frankie were a true phenomenon, the like of which you wonder if we'll ever see again. Lead singer Holly Johnson, HIV positive and away from pop's front line for a good decade, has come out of retirement to promo a Frankie retrospective. We took the opportunity to get him into the pod and look back at Frankie's story. I started by asking him whether he'd been reluctant to come back into the spotlight.
You know, I was very happily painting away in my studio when I was disturbed by a phone call. And as the song said, music is my first love. You know, I do live and breathe music, and when I'm painting, I'm listening to music all the time. What I found that there are so many more media events and media streams that you have to cover all the bases to just even be slightly visible in today's world. And I was terrified and shocked by the media scrum on the red carpet of the Q Awards. I've never experienced anything like this sort of mayhem of all the cameras.
What are your strongest memories of 84?
Well, of course, you know, it started off with us managing to scrape into the top 40 with Relax, that had hung around the nether regions of the charts for 3 months, and then doing Top of the Pops. I think it was the 20th birthday or 21st birthday edition. Really, after that, everything sort of exploded. A week or so later, the record was banned by the BBC, which caused a sort of press feeding frenzy. They really jumped on the fact that there were real live gay people in this group who would openly talk about their sexuality. I suppose the pinnacle of that was when our next single, Two Tribes, stayed at number one for 9 weeks, which hadn't been done since Bohemian Rhapsody. Relax re-entered the charts and went to number two. So we were number one and number two after being on the dole in Liverpool 6 months before. It was a complete, you know, head warp.
Defined an appropriate euphemism. You say this huge change in 6 months. Can you think of any individual instances where it was just like you recognised this, where you were right faced with how things had changed?
Arriving in New York and being taken to see the Pope of Pop, Andy Warhol, you know, and meeting him, who'd been a childhood hero of mine. We'd just done an interview for Interview over in the UK. And, he started signing the front of the Interview that we were in for me and gave it to me. And I said, and we were being photographed together in front of a Jean-Michel Basquiat painting. And I said, "Now, Andy, what do we have to do? What do I have to do to get on the cover of Interview?" And he said, "Oh, Holly, maybe you should sleep with the publisher." And I said, "Oh, who is the publisher, Andy?" Naively, "I am." Being propositioned by Andy Warhol was probably the high point,
that's
in fact, of 1984.
Working for the black
the whole kind of promotion and marketing and brand Frankie is a kind of whole issue in and of itself. But you were described by ZTT at the time as ferocious homosexuals. Was your aim to shock people?
Well, I didn't really set out to shock people too much. You know, I realised on watching Bow Wow Wow play Larks in the Park in Sefton Park in Liverpool, the element of spectacle was what was needed in music at that time, and you needed to push the boundaries. Really, you had to trump the Annabella Lewin naked cover. You know, you had to go even further, really, to create that sort of a frisson of excitement and to challenge the mores of the day. So it was at that point, really, that I said, you know, I felt this is what we have to do. We have to put on the leather knickers. We have to flaunt. We have to flaunt our sexuality and use some of Tom of Finland's imagery in the presentation of the band, really, to get any attention.
And do you think that has a legacy?
It has a legacy in terms of people remember the group as visual presence. And it was just before HIV and AIDS had really taken hold in the public's consciousness. And, you know, it was around about that time that I'd heard about people, so, you know, succumbing in America to HIV. And so there hadn't yet been a backlash mm-hmm. in the media against gay people. So it was just at a very crucial turning point in people's perceptions of gayness. There needed to be an in-your-face band who were unapologetic about their sexuality and weren't actually holding placards up outside the Houses of Parliament, which Jimmy Somerville, thank God for him, did. But they needed someone, I think, to be unapologetic about it, and because that, I think, was even more political in a sense.
I mean, that's what I was really wondering about, because, I mean, there is a... It is not a political issue anymore, and, you know, people have had to make gestures, make steps to get to that point.
Well, I think lately it's become a political issue again. During economic times... economic hard times, it's very often that you know, gay men and women get a lot of stick. There's a resurgence of homosexual or homophobic violence, I've noticed very much with the sad death of Michael Causa in Liverpool a couple of years ago, and more recently the trainee policeman Ian Bainham last week in London. And I think now more than ever, there is it is a time to stand up and for homophobia to be criminalised, really.
You do have plans to go back into the studio and record a new solo album, is that right?
I would hope so, yeah, I hope so. When all this fuss of Frankie Say's Greatest and the release of reissue of Blast and Dreams That Money Can't Buy, when it's died down a bit. I'd already been in talks with people, actually, about making another record. But obviously, you know, I can't compete with this, so I put that on hold until this... phase is over, really. Maybe after Christmas.
That was Holly Johnson of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and Frankie Say Greatest is out now on Universal Music TV. Time now to drag Rosie Swash into proceedings.
Hello.
Good day to you, Miss Swash.
Good day to you, Miss McInnes.
Do you remember Frankie Goes to Hollywood? Is that in anything you can recollect at all?
I don't remember them, but I know of them from, you know.
From legend.
Remember seeing the clips on I Love the 80s.
I Love the 80s in 2005, something passed down to you from your grandparents. Alongside you today, as I've previously mentioned, we have Alexis Petridis, Chief Pop Critic of The Guardian.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you very much. Did you ever have a Frankie t-shirt?
I had two.
I had
Frankie Say Relax and I had Frankie Say Arm the Unemployed.
Arm the Unemployed.
It's amazing when you look back on the career of Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Because, I mean, it's amazing when you look at pop music generally in 1984. Because for some reason, I've never quite been able to fathom, there's this sort of unbelievable kind of homosexualizing of the chart. If you look at the sort of bands that are, I mean, biggest band, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, hot new band, Bronski Beat, Smiths are the biggest indie band. There's loads of like explicitly gay themed high energy in the charts, like So Many Men, So Little Time by, you know, Miguel Brown. And then you get all these sort of like diva records. Gloria Gaynor doing a cover of I Am What I Am got in the charts. And it's just looks from this perspective, this absolutely remarkable thing. And it's not, you know, the kind of thing that was in the charts in those days. I'm sure John said, you should talk to John Savage about this, because I'm sure he's got, you know, a theory or two. But the stuff that was in the charts, it wasn't like a few glam bands camping it up. I mean, look at Paul Rutherford from Frankie Goes to Hollywood. He's a probably scary leather queen.
Right.
Bronski Beat's videos, it's people being guys going cruising in swim pools and stuff like that. So, I'm eternally fascinated by that.
1984. I mean, we haven't even mentioned Boy George, Marilyn, or the pop, or the pop people either.
No, absolutely.
Anyway, we didn't get you to come in to talk about sexual politics in 1984. We came to talk about albums. As I said earlier, we're going to try something different this week. Being that Alexis is the nation's preeminent rock critic, we thought we'd try and get our teeth into something a bit chewier. So instead of discussing single tracks, we're going to tackle an entire album. And that album this week is Phrases for the Young by Julian Casablancas. That was Out of the Blue from Phrases for the Young, the album under discussion this week. Now, Rosie, how about we start off with you and you give us a little bit of context about this album.
About this album? Well, I guess my impression of Julian Casablancas has always been, I was 18 or 19 when Is This It came out, and for that generation of people...
What? How old are you?
27.
And Is This It being the Strokes' debut
album. And for that generation of people, it was far enough away from anything that sounded like that in terms of that kind of garage rock, that it just sounded so fantastic and like nothing else that was out at that time. And then they kind of didn't really live up to the first album and the next two projects. And I think over this view came to be that the band were not so much these nihilistic, extremely cool New Yorkers and kind of rich kids with that were a bit of style over substance, which I do think is unfair, but I think, you know, hanging out with actresses and, you know, going out with famous people kind of overtook the music. Various side projects came along for other members, but never Casablancas, whose only solo effort since the Strokes, well, not solo, but that thing he did for Converse with Pharrell Williams, which just was like how to tell people that you don't give a shit about music if you do that. And then suddenly he's come out with this album, which everybody thinks is fantastic. And I think part of the context is that the feeling, that especially if you're the singer with no instrument of a band like that, even if you're the songwriter, people suspect you're a little bit of window dressing. This album, I think, is his suddenly coming out of nowhere and saying, I still write songs, I still do stuff which is relevant, I've just chosen not to for the last few years.
Okay, well, we'll get a little taster from the album now, and it's the single which has been on this pod before. It's 11th Dimension.
Mary.
So Alexis, that's the single there, 11th Dimension. Is that one of the better tracks on the album for you?
Yeah, I think it's a track that's sort of kind of symptomatic of what the album's about. And I think one of the really interesting, probably the most interesting thing about this album is that the last Strokes record I felt was a really concerted effort to get America to love them, because, you know, I think the nature of their success in Britain is very different to the nature of the success in America, and certainly in the States they were basically seen as kind of like an indie boy band, you know, whereas obviously in Britain they had this incredibly revitalising effect, you know, on the base of one record on sort of guitar music. Between them and the White Stripes, they really, you know what I mean, set the template for the rest of this decade in a lot of ways. And I thought the last Strokes album, they were really trying to, you know, prove their musicianship. There's a lot of guitar solos and all this kind of malarkey. And it was long, and it was, look at, you know what I mean? This is please take us seriously. And what this album does, I really like, is plays up to the exact opposite of that. You know, there isn't anything authentic about the Strokes. You know, that's not what's good about the Strokes. The inauthenticity of the Strokes is good. You know, a bunch of, you know, moneyed, beautiful, rich boys pretending to be kind of like Lower East Side smackheads from 1978. I mean, there's nothing authentic about that. And this, I think this is an album that embraces the kind of artifice in what, you know, Julian Casablancas does, and amps up the sort of popness of it. And it's a much, much more satisfying record, I think, than anything he's done since Is This It, really. And also there's that sort of sense of, like, why don't the Strokes make a record like this? Why have you saved these? I mean, it's not that far removed from what the Strokes do. If this was the new Strokes single, people would be going fucking nuts, you know? People go, this is amazing, this is a rebirth, this is a... And you just know that the next Strokes single is going to go dang, 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 and be kind of boring, you know what I mean?
Is this poppy enough for you, Rosie, this album?
It is indeed. I mean, how can you get more poppy than Gloria Estefan-esque chords at the beginning of a song? He said something really interesting about the album...
That's another first, yeah.
In August, he said, I wanted to capture the catchiness of modern music and at the same time get the power and seriousness of classical, older music in it. Not sure if he's done that. Generally, the goal is to expire. That's what art is supposed to do, expire.
Expire, as in pass away.
As in, this doesn't have to... yeah,
as in pass away. Die, that's what.
As in, it's got an expiration date, I guess, is what he's saying, is that you don't have to make something that everyone is going to love forever and that it should capture a moment in time, which I think it does. I think especially this song on it, I think it very much captures what's happening in music at the moment.
Okay, and we'll come back to you in a second. We'll first hear a little bit more music. This is Tourist. That was a bit of Tourist from Phrases for the Young by Julian Casablancas. Now, Rosie, is that one of the... Do you think that's a bit more of the classic rock sound he's talking about?
I guess it is. I mean, I was kind of attracted to the little tiny, you know, Eastern twang of the guitar that he's got on the beginning. I thought that was quite nice. But I actually picked this one because what we were also discussing before was the lyrics, the lyrical content of this album. And I can barely understand what he's singing on most of it. And this is one of the only songs where I can actually hear very clearly what he's singing. But I still don't really know what it all means. And I suspect it means nothing. I feel like a tourist lost in the suburbs, out, you know, out in the swampland. He says urban sprawling a bit. You know, it's kind of obvious. I came a bit out. I feel a bit lost, feel a bit outside. But in general, one of the problems that I have with this album is that you have to struggle to understand what he's singing, and then, as in literally what words he's saying, and then even then you just think, well, what's that supposed to mean?
You kind of pick up catchphrases, don't you, really,
yeah,
from
exactly.
It? You pick up little quotables. Do you think that's part of the same aesthetic that's at work in the musical composition?
I think he's always been a sort of pretty, you know, lyrics are not Strokes' forte. It's not like anybody listened. What Is This It did, I think, quite successfully, is project a very appealing notion of sort of insouciant kind of nihilistic cool, you know, in a very New York kind of way. But it's not really about anything, you know. And certainly I remember the lyrics on First Impressions of Earth, which is absolutely rubbish, you know. So, I mean, Terry, there's one song that went, I took a shit, it was fine. Thanks for sharing. Direct those inquiries to Dr. Gillian McKeith in future. You know, so I don't think that's the kind of, you know, it's more about a, I think it's more about a feeling that he generates with his vocals than sort of searing lyrical insight.
So yeah, he's got Out of the Blue and Yes, I Know I'm Going to Hell in a Leather Jacket.
You see, that's exactly what, you know what I mean? It's exactly, oh babe, I'm running out of luck, like my sister, I don't give a fuck, as it said on the first track, which is sort of kind of what you want. I'm going to hell in a leather jacket, I'm going to do this, I'm a...
And the next line in the couplet is, you're pissing on my casket, so he gets the gratuitous swearing there as well. Which
pissing on my casket, wow.
Okay, we'll give another taste from the album, a final taste from the album, in fact. This is Left and Right in the Dark. So that was Left and Right in the Dark by Julian Casablancas from Phrases for the Young. What I do think is quite good about this album, when it works, and I do think this track is one of them, is that it has a magpie-ish attitude to where it's getting its sounds from.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than, I think, than just the synth pop combined with the strokes with the bass taken out.
Yeah.
There are, and you've mentioned it in your review, there's a bit of southern soul in there. Mm-hmm. This track, I think, is incredibly 80s from a lot of different angles. It's got, I think, something like a Phil Collins rhythm in there. They've got Police-style Walking on the Moon chords, a bit of Van Halen guitar tone, even a bit, there's an acoustic kind of little arpeggio breakdown. And that sounds like something you can imagine John Cougar Mellencamp doing or something. and again, I think it comes back to the central idea, really, that this is a brazen piece of appropriation, but he's put it together in a collage, which is still hooky and catchy in and of itself. And when he's being playful like that, when he's being cheeky, It has a force, I think. But you get towards the end of the album, Glass, and also Tourist, I think, and the tracks get a bit more contemplative, a bit longer, and it starts to lose my attention.
I think the songs are too long, generally. I think that's the main problem with them. There's only like, what is it, 8 songs on the album or something.
Yeah.
And I thought all of them could have done with losing 2 minutes. They're all about 4.5 minutes long.
Yeah.
And, you know, that ain't pop music, baby. You know, you should cut it down. And I just thought all of them could do with a trim. But I would say I agree with your point about the kind of playful assimilation of different influences. And I thought with the single, 11th Dimension, that organ part on it that you said was like Miami Sound Machine or Gloria Estefan or something, it's a really good point because it does sound like that. But also, it could be like the organ part from a garage rock record from 1966. Yeah. It could be from a Question Mark and the Mysterians record. It could also be that kind of organ that they play at American sports games, you know, like ice hockey games or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just sort of thought that's a really clever... you know. And I sort of thought that's a really clever sort of thing to do. There's a lot of different, you know... sort of signifiers in one sound there, you know. It sounds sort of... Yeah, I just thought that was sort of quite clever and showed a kind of depth of thinking. I may just be putting all this, or you may just good organ sound, I don't know. But, you know, it showed us...
This is the one slight thing that kind of, when people say that journalists are redundant, is that if we didn't have journalists and you didn't have interviews with Julian Casablancas, you would be convinced that this is what he was doing, making something playful and actually quite artistic. But you listen to them speak and you start thinking, well, actually, we may be giving them a little bit more credit than...
Absolutely. But it's interesting, you know, I mean, that's sort of... I suppose you could say it's symbolic of how, what kind of rock music is now for the most part, which is magpie, you know, borrowings, sort of postmodern magpie borrowing from other eras thrown together. And you sort of judge its success to a greater or lesser degree, not on its sort of originality in the sense of, well, this sounds like nothing I've ever heard, but how have you thrown these influences together? Have you done it cleverly or not?
Okay, so that's Phrases for the Young by Julian Casablancas. We've chatted it around, I feel, enough at this point. So let's bring it to a conclusion. I'd like to go to each of you and get a review in a sentence, a summary of your feelings on this album. Alexis.
Better than the last two Strokes albums.
It doesn't come any more endorseful than that. Rosie Swash.
While I agree with Alexis's...
This is going to be two sentences.
Summary. I haven't got to it yet.
Okay.
My sentence is, it sounds brilliant at first, but it lacks some of the natural highs and lows that would make it a lasting piece of pop music.
Full stop?
Full stop.
Full yes. stop. And well, mine will be great parts, not always assembled in the right order. And there you go. That is the inaugural Album Club. Do let us know what you think of this feature. It was prompted by one of our Facebook friends. So we're really keen to hear your feedback on it. We can work it up. We can make it better, I'm sure.
We can stop doing it altogether if you don't like it.
Don't say that. We don't want to hear that. We'll give it 3 months. And if it's dreadful, we'll cut it off then. But no, 3 months is at least before we do that. So let us know your thoughts on guardian.co.uk/musicweekly or on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook, search Music Weekly. At this point in the show, we would normally have a montage of the other singles out to buy this week. Instead, we'll give you the remaining 4 tracks from Phrases for the Young by Julian Casablancas. So, Alexis, Patridis, thank you so much for coming in to join us today.
Always a pleasure and never a chore.
Never. How did you feel that format went for you? Has it got promise?
No, I think it has. Yeah, I think it's interesting because it enables you to discuss things in a bit more depth than the Singles Club.
We've got the thumbs up from the big man, so thanks again for coming in.
My pleasure.
Next up, it's another electric interview, this time with Sparks. That's This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us by Sparks, our second guest this week. Trumping Frankie's anniversary by a whole 14 years, Sparks, aka brothers Ron and Russell Mayle, formed in 1970 and have come a long way, baby. Is that not true, Rosie?
Yes. How best to describe the Mayle brothers? What I did say to producer Peter was like John Waters to music, which I think is a bit reductionist, but...
It's just because they've got the silly moustache.
I mean, they've had 21 albums, so obviously they've managed to cover just about every base from glam to electro pop to God knows what, and they have a gift for, I mean, talking about puns and wordplay, they love a bit of weird wordplay and manage to make the mundane seem incredibly weird and the weird seem totally normal. And I also think what's interesting about them is the last 20, 30 years of pop music can kind of be traced a little bit through them. They were discovered by Todd Rundgren. They worked with Giorgio Moroder. They collaborated with Faith No More. Morrissey's a big fan. There's something about them that seems to speak to everyone. And just when you think you know where they are with them, they come back with an hour-long composition called The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman, which is all about the Swedish existential director. It's theorising on what would happen if Bergman did actually become a huge mainstream director and move to Hollywood, and how would he cope with it? And it's an hour-long musical piece. So I met with the Brothers Mayle when they were in London last week to talk about it. And, it's pretty obvious as concepts go, but I had to find out what was so inspiring about Bergman.
Well, when we were going to school, there were kind of only two sorts of films. There were foreign films, which were all lumped together. It didn't matter what country it was from. It was just foreign films, and there were American films. So to kind of be thought of as being hip, you had to only like the foreign films and not the American films. And in general, the American films were more glossy and superficial and had bigger budgets, but the European films, and then sort of including Bergman in whatever, even though it's not European, but in that sort of genre, they kind of dealt more with real issues, even at the point of being pretentious about it, because when you're a university student, you really tend to love pretentious things. That's kind of part of being a student. And so these kind of dealt with issues, maybe even naively, but just kind of questioning things. And Bergman in particular kind of probed things that were the big issues about life and death and God and those sorts of things, that stylistically they were so different from American films because they were a lot of times really spare. They weren't cheap looking, they were just spare. And American films always had to have a ton of music and a ton of people moving around.
I demand to know where we're going. Have you ever seen Hollywood before? If it is your first time, well, I hope we're going to see you lots, lots more.
Because what kept leaping out at me when I was listening to the composition was the sense, like the very literal sense that he has no control, in that he doesn't know where he is, he doesn't know how he got to Hollywood. And I just wondered how much of your own psyches, you know, ebbed into the script, how much of you were in the character of Bergman when you were writing him.
Well, I think that I used artists with the small a at the beginning, but whenever you're in a band, you kind of think that you're in control of the situation, but it's only you're kind of fooling yourselves in some way when you do that. So we kind of are always feeling like we're in that situation, like some mythical place where how much are we willing to compromise and how much do we want to just be, you know, hard and fast about things. Because less so now, but when we were working with producers, you would kind of relinquish some of your own I don't know what you would call it, but your own vision and kind of feeling of rightness about things, just because you trusted that person's feelings about things because they had a track record. Now we kind of are more hard-headed about things and just say we don't care, we're going to do it this way.
I wanted to ask you about a recent song of yours, which I loved, Dick Around, is all about sort of reveling in slovenliness and just enjoying it, which is actually something that people, even who pursue that kind of lifestyle, find quite hard to do. And I thought, and it struck me that, you know, for the amount of material, the amount of albums you guys have had, I find it very hard to believe that there's anything autobiographical in a song that's around about sort of sitting around playing with your balls all day. Are you, you know, is that your sort of guilty pleasure, doing nothing? Surely someone who, you know, surely a band with such a prolific output can't get away with doing nothing.
Well, we're in this position where we can kind of rationalize it as you're kind of in this period where you're absorbing influences, and so you don't want to kind of have any kind of action getting in the way. So by doing nothing,
you're still doing something.
Yeah, well, that's what I tell myself. That's what I tell myself. Actually, I'm doing nothing because I'm really actually pretty professional at digging around. But you kind of try to fool yourself into thinking that it really is important to have that reflective period so that something important will come along the way next.
Is there, I mean, there must be, you know, bands that come and go that you see this, you know, the seed of sparks in them and think, well, we thought of that first, so we did that.
Yes.
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 That's a very
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
And it's a
Patcha Boys.
Who are you, sir? No. Excuse me.
So no one, just a yes then, it's just an affirmative. Brilliant. Okay, my final question for you is, you know, you're still obviously very immersed in the seduction, and you were talking about the visual aspects of it earlier in cinematic, so this is obviously on your mind. Have you at all thought about the next thing? You know, or are you totally cocooned in a project until it's over and then you move on?
Well, I think in this case in particular, we want to see where it goes. In the past, we would sort of, you know, be thinking ahead because it's an album and you are kind of, you're always trying to write. And so, but this one where even just the arena that we're working in, we're not even sure what that is. We kind of want to see where it's going to go before we decide what we want to do next. And so
we approached a few theater production companies that where there's some interest to see if there's a way to stage this in a different way than just Sparks going on stage and doing kind of variations of what we've done in the past, like three albums or so, where we've had it be a sort of minimal theatrical kind of production where we have projections with us, but to see if we can do it in a broader way even. Send an angel down to me, lead me from this barren land. How the hell can I believe if you withhold your guiding hand? Oh my God, exist. Oh my God, do you exist? Do you exist? Do you exist? That was Russell and Ron Mayle of Sparks, and The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman is out now.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Rosie. Yeah, because of our extended album club, there is no feature with no name this week. It will return next week, do not fear. But something to celebrate, the return of Portishair on the blog. One of our most beloved contributors, who came up with about 32 different names for the feature with no name, all of which were rejected. I think he's still calling it Sniffing Old Glitter. Never mind. But he returns the blog and he says, it doesn't often happen, but I hated Rosie's choice on Singles Club. The first 10 seconds really grabbed me, and I even made a note of the band, but I found the repetitive part of the vocal really very shit. Note has been scribbled out. Love the Frenchman, though. By that, he's talking about Francois and the Atlas Mountains, which you also reviewed last week. And I will buy it for my girlfriend, I think. There's nothing more we like to hear about than presents for significant others on this podcast. Rosie.
Richard Cleaves said on our Facebook site, thanks for the in-depth Linville Golding feature. The specials were really quite special, coming from someone who had all the 7 inches first time round. His music selections are classics, if a bit obvious, in my opinion.
Little diss for Linville there, backhanded diss. Miss Wonder on the blog said, brilliant interview with Linville Golding. Great tunes and just seemed like a lovely all-round guy. One final message, still no podcast mention, it says. And that's from... Oh, hang on. No, I've mislaid it. It's gone.
Unlucky.
Oh, never mind. well, that is it from this week's pod. glad to have had you with us. Especially glad to have had Rosie Swash here.
Many thanks.
Yes, great. We'll both be back this time next week, if this time is Friday, which it ought to be. And we'll see you then. Bye-bye.